The sound of bagpipes and the sight of green banana bags in the emergency department can mean only one thing. It's March. And this March, we're going to be doing a little extra pharmacology with our own Chris Edwards. We're also going to be talking to some of our orthopedists about how to do a good consultation, along with talking with billing and coding, once again, on how to document those wonderful splints that you play so well for all of those drunken foosh injuries. So hold on to your kilt, because here we come. Remember a couple months ago, before the end service, when we sat down and talked with Chris Edwards about sedation and analgesia? Well, we got him again, and this time we're talking more about vasoactive drugs. Not just pressures, but drugs that can actually bring your blood pressure down as well. It was a really great discussion. So we brought him back on, and we're going to discuss this a little bit so that you can decide, do I want my patient's blood pressure too high or too low? And just as a reminder to everybody, it is Mustache March, or as Sreekar likes to call it, March. And as many of you guys know, Dan Hayes, one of our beloved ED pharmacists, has left us. And in honor of him, I wanted to put a little bit of theme music to our pharmacology talks. So Dan, this one is for you. And your mom. Her middle name is Mudbone, and on top of all that, your mama got a glass eye with the fish in it. Your mama got a glass eye with the fish in it. Your mama got a glass eye with the fish in it. Jared and I are sitting down with Chris Edwards, one of our awesome ED pharmacists, and we're going to talk a little bit about pressors until Jared decided he actually preferred to talk about vasoactive medications, so that's what we're going to talk about instead.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking about how to make somebody's blood pressure go up, but we never talk about how to make somebody's blood pressure go down, so maybe let's start
I'm really good at that.
So I was talking to a couple of the residents the other day about hypertensive emergencies, hypertensive crises, and the medications of choice to bring the blood pressure down. And my response to their question was that it depends on why your blood pressure is high and what else you have going on. So let's just say you had a thoracic aortic dissection in the emergency department. Blood pressure was sky high. What would you recommend?
I'm going to assume in this situation the heart rate's also pretty high.
Yeah.
So I'd probably start with Esmolol, and I'd be fairly aggressive with it. One of the things I see go wrong with Esmolol quite a bit is we don't give that initial bolus that you need to sort of get ahead of the curve before starting the drip. So I'd give her an Esmolol bolus and then start the drip fairly aggressively and sort of go from there.
Let's say your heart rate came down to 60, but your blood pressure was still high. Then what would you do?
I'd probably add nicardipine on top of that. I like both of those agents because they have a fairly short duration and they're easily and quickly titratable.
Mm-hmm.
So not only can you get to your target blood pressure a little bit faster, but you can also, if it does something you don't like, if you bottom out their pressure, you can turn it off. And within 10 to 15 minutes, you should see that drug go away.
Mm-hmm. I do it a little bit differently. I do like Esmolol, and I use Nipride with it. And the reason I do is because you can pinpoint exactly what you want the pressure to be and the heart rate to be, and it's even faster than nicardipine. That being said, as soon as they get to the ICU, if they're not going to go to the OR, then I switch them to nicardipine. But at least you can get them where you want faster with the Nipride. That's just my thought.
And that's my primary concern with starting people on nitroprusside. I think it's good for short-term use, but it's scary in the ED because we don't often have labs on these guys. We don't know what the renal function's like. And with nitroprusside, you can see cyanide toxicity with extended infusions in patients with renal dysfunction. So
Yvonne's the ICU pharmacist. She says you really have about 3 days before you get the cyanide toxicity, and they can spike the bag with cyanocobalamin. So
true.
My thought is, in the emergency department, Nipride and Esmolol are fine, but I think that labetalol is probably not the right drug.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you on that one as well. Again, just boiling down to the pharmacokinetics of it, labetalol sticks around for a while, so if you overshoot your mark, you're going to be stuck with that for quite some time. So I'm not a big fan of labetalol, particularly in these high acuity situations, hypertensive emergencies.
And the cardiothoracic surgeons like labetalol because it's one drug, but if you look at the oral alpha to beta, it's like 4 to 3 or something. But if you look at the IV alpha to beta, it's 1 to 7. So it's not as good of a drug IV as you think it is in terms of blocking both alpha and beta receptors. So what do you do, Aaron, for thoracic aortic dissections, hypertensive?
So I've only had two of those. The first one I used Esmolol, and they did fine. The second one I used nicardipine and nitroprusside, and that's because I was in the unit, and that's what I was told to use. So my experience is limited, but I had good effects with both of them. Neither of them ended up going to surgery. They were just monitored in the unit, and we reduced their shear pressure, and that's the big thing. Every time they take a stroke of their heart, the shear pressure is going to extend that dissection little by little. So you're trying not just to lower their blood pressure, but you're trying to lower their stroke volume. Or, am I saying that correctly?
You're saying it right.
So I kind of stumbled through that, but let me make sure I say that clearly. The important thing you're trying to accomplish with the thoracic aortic dissection is to reduce the shear pressure. And that is best first accomplished by a beta blocker because it's a negative ionotrope. You're going to be preventing a lot of the sudden jump from diastole to systole, and you're decreasing the shear pressure so that you're not extending that dissection. And to summarize what Chris and Jared were saying, they like Esmolol. They also like nicardipine, which is what Chris was saying, and Jared likes nitroprusside. Both of those are going to get your blood pressure down, but they recommend starting with the beta blocker so that you don't get the reflex tachycardia that you would get by dropping the blood pressure on its own with purely a vasoactive medication.
Let's say a head bleed, subarachnoid or intraparenchymal bleed, it's hypertensive. Then what's your choice then?
I like nicardipine again. You know, I think that in that situation, you typically just see high blood pressure, you don't see a lot of effect on heart rate. Usually they're not super tachycardic. And nicardipine is basically just going to cause vasodilation, which is going to drop your blood pressure without affecting your heart rate. So I would go with that initially.
I like nicardipine in that situation too. What about you?
I do too. I've always used nicardipine. I've had great effect with it. It's easily titratable. It's a number I can remember. It's a really, really good drug, and it's something that's more supported by the literature as far as my review.
Yeah, don't use hydralazine. One thing that people talk about with vasoactive drugs that bring your blood pressure down. So we have hydralazine, nitroprusside, and nitroglycerin. Mm-hmm. So let's say you had somebody whose blood pressure was sky high, they had pulmonary edema and heart failure from it. And some people will say start high dose nitro. Some people say start nipride. Some people say give hydralazine. And let me get your opinion.
Yeah, this is a tough situation because there's not a ton of evidence to support the use of any one of these agents. So it boils down to the physiologic effects of the drugs and really which one makes the most sense in the situation. I think that's where you're going with it,
yeah.
So I'll punt it back to you.
Well, they all act by the same mechanism.
Right.
They all end up acting on the nitric oxide pathway, one way or the other. So if you put somebody on 100 or 200 mics of nitro, you're assuming that the higher dose of nitro is going to give you arterial dilation compared to more venodilation that you get at the lower doses. But the way they figured those studies out is they put a blood pressure cuff on somebody's arm and put an IV and an A-line in, give them each of the drugs to see which pressure dropped more.
Yeah, not a great way to study.
Yeah, we don't really know systemically what it does. So
if
you're going to egregious doses of nitro, you could get methemoglobinemia. So I think that it's probably better to just start a different drug, even if you do nitroprusside.
I agree, and I think it's going to work on the same pathway, but possibly favor the arterial side more than the venous side. I would probably go that route as well. When you start getting to really, really high doses, 300-400 mics per minute of nitro, I'd start thinking about adding a second agent.
Yeah, I agree. Hydralazine's a drug for a medicine intern on the floor who has somebody gets a call from a nurse on high blood pressure.
Yeah, it's too hard to titrate, and if you don't like what it did, you're stuck with it for a long time. So,
what do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think that nitro, I'm comfortable with fairly high doses up into the 100 or so. And then after that, I'm like, yeah, we got to switch. We're too close to missiles. We're switching to guns. So
yeah, I agree.
We need another agent. So let me ask you, this is kind of a thought-provoking question that I guarantee you there's not a lot of evidence of. when you have a patient that's in shock, do you reach for something that's actually going to maybe augment them in a way that would lower their blood pressure?
So I did this a couple weeks ago, and I told the residents, don't ever do this unless I'm around. I've done it twice in the last month. One time was, we'll talk about the easy one, the beta blockers. So there's some evidence to support that if you bring somebody's heart rate down, if they're in septic shock, that you...
Okay, stop what you're doing. Pay attention. Listen to Jared. Because if you only hear the first part of using beta blockers in septic shock, you're going to kill someone. Jared, please continue.
Now, in the studies, there's one in JAMA. In the study that they did, they brought it down to like less than 100 or something,
right,
I think.
Right.
I'll only do it if they have an egregiously high heart rate. And if they're like 170 or 180, then I'll bring them down to something reasonable, which in my mind is less than 130. Because the thought is that if you give their heart more time to fill, they're going to get a higher stroke volume. So super high heart rates, I'll give them a beta blocker to bring it down to something reasonable. Something reasonable to me is less than 130. What do you think?
Yeah, I saw that study and thought it was really interesting. I haven't tried it clinically at this point, but I think it's definitely an interesting idea, and it makes sense physiologically, and there's some evidence to back it up, but I don't think that's necessarily I don't think that study was a practice changer for me. I don't think it's going to make its way into the next surviving sepsis guidelines.
It's definitely not
like
something I would do routinely.
Yeah,
it's if you put the ultrasound probe on their heart and it doesn't look like their heart's filling because they're so tachycardic and they don't look like they need any more fluid or whatever, I would maybe bring their heart rate down a little bit, but it's not something I'd do routinely.
That's something I'm not going to do without Jared around either.
The other thing I did recently was somebody was in septic shock and they had like no pulse pressure, and I was giving them epi and I gave them a little nipride too, so definitely don't do that unless I'm around.
So one of the times that I've actually done this with kids is kids that go into septic shock, they don't do the typical thing that you'd expect where they have high cardiac output and low SVR. You can get kids that will switch back and forth and back and forth over the matter of minutes to hours. And I've seen this in the PICU where we've had a kid that on one moment was on dopamine and norepi, and then the next moment was on dobutamine and nitroprusside, because the kid switched from having a very low SVR and we just couldn't fill their vasculature enough to clamping down, having a super high SVR, and not even so much because of the vasoactive drugs. We titrated them off, and still the kid's clinical exam was that they had very, very high SVR and their heart was starting to sag. So we pushed their heart and we very, very delicately opened up their systemic vascular resistance, and the kid ended up doing fine. But the intensivist was like, yeah, we do this sometimes, it happens. This is one of those weird things that kids do that I go, well, I'm glad I know who to call in case my kid decides to do this. But just keep in mind that your exam will help guide what you're going to do for your pressor selection.
That's up an excellent point that I wanted to talk about, which was pressure doesn't equal flow. And so let's say that kid that you're talking about has a MAP of 90. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have blood flow to their skin and their vital organs. In that case, let's say their heart's not working, but their systemic vascular resistance is sky high. They're going to have a great blood pressure. It's going to be at goal, but their skin's going to get more mottled and their organs are going to fail more because they don't have any blood flow. Those are the patients that have really high mixed venous oxygen saturations because they're just shunting past their organs. And those patients need a vasodilator. So the other point I wanted to bring up was that a MAP of 65 isn't always the right thing to do. Sometimes it's just a number. So the patient that I gave nipride to the other day, she at a MAP of 65, she had a blood pressure of like 79 over 74, which has no pulse pressure, but it's a MAP greater than 65, and she had mottled skin. When I drove her blood pressure up to a MAP of 90, her pulse pressure opened up and she started perfusing better. So you got to be thoughtful about how you mix these drugs up. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, you know, just as a disclaimer, I wouldn't do these things without, you know, somebody who's critical care trained around. But I think if you think about the pharmacologic activity of the agents that you're using in relation to the clinical situation that's presenting itself, you know, if you've got somebody who's super clamped down, you know, you could make a case for causing a little bit of vasodilation in order to get, you know, adequate perfusion, and then using another agent to sort of augment cardiac output. It's one of the nice things about dobutamine is you get an increase in cardiac output, but you also get vasodilation. Something to think about when you start that agent is that you could actually see a reduction in the number and their blood pressure, but you are increasing their cardiac output. It's just the dobutamine will also decrease your systemic vascular resistance. And in that situation, I wonder if dobutamine would be a good choice.
She was on dobutamine, but I agree. Yeah, that's what I tend to do. And I think you can guide those things by looking at the SVO2 and the lactate and whatnot. Blood pressure is like age. It's just a number. What you really want to know is your metabolism benefiting from it?
Spoken like somebody who doesn't want to recall his age anymore.
So nice, succinct, and to the point. Thank you so much, Chris. Next month, we're going to bring him back on, and we're going to finish off the talk with pressors, things that actually bring your blood pressure up. So we're going to move a little bit to the clinical pearls aspect of AZMCast. We talked to a bunch of our orthopedic residents. We know that they are the ones on the other end of that pager, and they're the ones that come down. And quite frankly, they're some of the nicest people that we deal with. So I wanted to ask them a little bit about what we can do to become better consultants, ask smarter questions, and all around take better care of our patients. And they were very nice to oblige.
I know, yeah. Us prissy ED docs, we always need our podcasts and our technology, right? What would we be without a CT scanner? While we rock climb or cycle or brew beer. I think that's the ED stereotype pretty much. Nothing wrong with that. All right. So I've got several of our orthopedic residents here. If you guys want to just introduce yourself real quick and tell us what year you are.
Dave Bennett, fifth year. Paul Ruckus, the first year. Andrew Rowan, third year.
So thank you guys for being with us. So we're going to talk about consults this week. So first question I have is, so it's about 2 a.m. and it's a Saturday night, and you're usually by yourself, maybe a med student, which can help or hurt. So it's 2 a.m., you get a consult from the ED. How much information do you want from us?
I think sometimes it varies. I mean, obviously, if it's a complicated situation with a complicated history, I kind of want the Cliff's Notes, but the bulk of the information. If it's something routine, like a distal radius fracture, a hip fracture in an old person, that's kind of enough. You know, the basic past medical history, this is the injury. You know, we all know it's going to be operative or it's going to need a reduction or whatever. So for the run-of-the-mill stuff, I think less information is fine. I really don't need to know about all of the medications they're on if all I'm going to be doing is reducing their risk and sending them home.
I personally like it in a certain kind of order. I like to start off with just the MRN and the name and the room number so that if I'm happen to be by a computer when some right off the bat, then I can start pulling it up, start looking at films and before we're even off the phone. I've heard before that some of the ED has been taught that you should start with like a one-liner or two-liner of what you have, that we have a 19-year-old with this, that, not like in the ED. But personally, just for me at least, I like to just start off with the MRN, the name, and the room, so I can already start pulling it up and then go with the story afterwards.
I want to know the fracture, first thing. What's the fracture? What's the injury? And then name, MRN, so forth. Some things don't need to be seen. If it's a non-displaced, ulnar fracture, that kind of thing. I want to know what I'm dealing with, first of all.
So that's one of the things that I think makes it hard for us is everybody does have their own style. And so I think we just need to be open to the fact that some people like it one way, some people like it another way, and just kind of get ourselves set for that. Do you want to get a story for what's going on, or would you rather just get the problem of, hey, here's what's going on? I think Dave kind of alluded to that. Do you want the big, long story? This was an 86-year-old lady, and she's got cats, and her cat ran in front of her, and then her cat tripped. And I mean, what happens when you do that, when you hear that at 2 in the morning? Do your eyes gloss over and you fall back asleep? Or
I don't know. I actually don't mind getting a little bit of a story because I feel like then I can better make a judgment since I haven't been doing it as long. And I need to see this now or I don't need to see it. It gives me all the information I get there. I tend to write down the important stuff. So then if I forget to ask, I already have it, or I already just have a better idea, I think, going into it of what I'm about to see.
I think that's a good point. You mentioned, you know, should I see this now or not? Because otherwise, if you're not seeing the consult in the ED, you're playing Xbox or you're sleeping or something else like that, right? That's pretty much all that you guys do is see consults in the ED all day, all night, and occasionally you wander by the OR, correct?
Correct.
Sounds, yeah, exactly.
So you guys get consults from the rest of the floor. You guys get consults from outside hospitals sometimes. I know, Dave, I called you from South Campus the other day about a lady with a hip fracture. You have all the people you got to manage on the floor. How many different attendings do you guys serve at a time on your list?
We have four main ortho trauma attendings. So at all times, you know, we have typically anywhere from 15 down to like 8 or so primary patients with them. And then all the consults we get through the day, which probably ranges from maybe 5 to 6 during a day, like, you know, day shift time. On a lighter day, it's up to 10 or so. But we also have all the cross cover that we get called for during, which is, so that's all our other services. And normally there's at least probably 5, 6 of their patients when it comes down to Dr. Miller's joints patients and Dr. Kilder's foot and ankle, Dr. Shepherd's shoulder people, and Dr. Shirani's spine patients. So we don't always really deal with their problems. If it's during daylight hours, we can refer them. But we normally at least are getting pages from them and have them call them back and answer some basic questions.
All right, so I'll ask you guys if you could each give me one thing that makes up a good consult call that makes you like, okay, I need to go see this patient. This is not necessarily a matter of urgency, but I know what's going on. This person I'm calling has it together, and I know what I'm getting into. I need to go down there.
I think more than anything, it's either already having a diagnosis and kind of an established plan that they just need us on board for. You know, if they anticipate that this person's going to need surgery or a reduction that they need our help with. Or if they just really don't know that they're upfront about it. You know, this is going on. I don't know what to do. That's why we're bringing you on board. Not just the, we have a guy with ankle pain.
Yeah, I would agree. I think just having done a good neurovascular exam, having taken off any splints or dressings that they already have on them, visualizing fracture and what we're working with, and then often just having a brief read for the, whatever it is. It doesn't happen very often, but every once in a while you'll get a imaging study without any read and say, this is what I have, and then we'll look at it and say, I don't know if I quite agree with you, and then it ends up being nothing. So, you know, it's I know it's annoying to wait for the radiologist a lot of times, but sometimes it saves you guys and us time if we just wait and get a wet read.
They have pager numbers too, and whether or not they'll answer them is a different story, but that's something that we can often try to get a jump on if we're really eager to get that read. Dave, what do you think?
I think the most important thing is having a question or a reason for the consultation, basically just something that you need to know from us. The patients work up to a certain point, you know, you need more information or just some guidance or need to know what the preference is of the attending who's on call.
Okay.
Or also with that, like, is there a surgical intervention? No, obviously if there's reduction that needs to be done, but otherwise for soft tissue stuff, is it something surgical intervention? Is this just a cellulitic or soft superficial infection that without any sort of drainable collection? You know, I know it's in the hand and we're on hand call, but it's nothing that where you can physically do surgery on, and it's probably not really our management at that point, at least.
We need to know that too. We need to know if it is our management or not, so we need to know all of those things. You can call us for those, but it is nice to have an idea if it is surgical or not.
What are some of the aspects of a bad consult that make you just want to hang up the phone right there?
I think the first and foremost, the biggest one is if you haven't seen the patient. I know you guys, you know, you sign out from one to another. So we get that consult every now and then. Oh, this patient has just signed out to me. I haven't seen them, but and that's not really helpful for us because if we have any follow-up questions, you know, nobody can answer it. And so normally when that happens, I mean, it doesn't happen too often, but when it does, I just say, please see the patient, give me a call back. Or, you know, if there's no x-rays, no labs, no kind of basic workup started, then I'm saying, well, why don't we get some labs, why don't we get some x-rays, and then call me back, and that sort of thing. And that's just kind of a waste of everyone's time.
It doesn't happen to you that often, but if you lump all the consultants together, I bet it happens more often than you think.
I think that's pretty much along the same lines. Sometimes we'll get a few calls where they have an orthopedic diagnosis or an established diagnosis, and so we'll get jumped on my bandwagon, a quick consult, but it may not be even relevant to what's going on. I think that's more commonly from the floor. and from medicine and other services and not in the ED, but a lot of times we will get calls and they'll be like, they have a dressing on their knee and it must be an infected knee. And we'll say, well, have you taken down the dressing, looked at it, just look red, just look erythematous, this kind of, this and that, and swelling. And they'll, I've looked at it, still in the dressing. So, but again, that's probably less likely in the ED. I think they're a lot better about taking down dressings and such.
I think that the worst consults I've had have been the ones where the resident or the attending has already told the patient what is going to happen surgically, and it's not been correct, and I have to go in and then backpedal a bunch and try and, you know, save everyone's face a little bit. And those ones have been the most difficult for me, but I agree with them too.
Along that same line, it definitely is a hard balance to strike, because I know from your guys' standpoint, we probably say more often than not, you know, this person needs to be admitted to medicine for co-workup management, but it does happen fairly often where sometimes the ball will already be rolling with the medicine admin. We'll get down there and be like, oh, this doesn't need to come in-house, or we would have sent this out. And then by then, a lot of times I've seen it, they just end up getting admitted because the ball's already kind of rolling, and that's the plan that's been made. So it's a fine balance to strike. But
and just to add one more, occasionally we'll get a call about, you know, oh, I have this patient with a whatever injury, a distal radius fracture, I've done the reduction, do you mind taking a look at the x-rays and telling me if it's adequate? And to me, that's, I also don't like those, simply because if it's not adequate, now you have to, you know, redo a sedation or a hematoma block or whatever it is. And, you know, I have to show all these images to my attending in the morning, so if it's kind of borderline and then I show it to my attending and say, well, I didn't want to put the patient through another sedation, you know, when I'm now sending out a poorly reduced fracture or whatever. So in those cases, I'd much rather, you know, if you guys want to do the reduction, I'm always happy with that. If you call me and say, hey, we're going to do a reduction, I'd like you there just to make sure that everything works out. I'm happy to come down and just be present.
But at South Campus, that's okay, I think. That's a different situation. We're not in-house. We don't have a 24/7 night float yet. And so we rely on reductions to be done, and I think it's okay for us to review the post-reduction films in those cases. So it's a real situational thing. It's certainly a gray area.
Do you guys ever feel like you're trying to be sold a consult from the ED? Like someone's trying to, hey, no, you should really go see, oh, no, it's fascinating, interesting. Nothing like that? No, because we do.
Occasionally. And again, I think it's one of those things, if you're upfront about it, like, hey, listen, you know, this, we want you on board so we can tell the patient that there's nothing really going on, or that, you know, or we really don't know what's going on. Would you please see him? We need help with diagnosis. I mean, that's fine as long as you're upfront with it. I think occasionally we do get the ones, it's not too often, thankfully, where really it's like, why am I seeing this, you know? Again, if you're upfront about it, I don't mind saying anything.
How much do we need to know about your job in order to call a good consult question? Do we need to know the surgical management? Do we need to just be able to recognize the emergent stuff? I mean, I've always been taught that you need to know what we need to know and then a little bit more. Because every once in a while, it seems like, well, that just doesn't make sense to me. And we'll call and I'll ask all the time. I go, look, I don't agree with that, but then again, I haven't done an orthopedic residency, so can you explain to me what's going on? I mean, how much more would it be helpful if we knew what you guys did?
I'm not sure. I mean, for us at least, I feel like, you know, our different attendings will often have different ways of managing things. So sometimes it's literally a question of who's on call. You know, even if an ankle has to be, you know, fixed with surgery, some people prefer to do it, you know, the next day, and some people prefer to have it go to clinic and come back. Same thing with, you know, hand problems and some of these non-emergent things. I think the biggest thing to recognize is, you know, the emergent situations, things where we need to be called, you know, sooner rather than later, things like native hip dislocations, Taylor neck fractures, concern for compartment syndrome, things like that.
Okay. Now, I went to residency here, and I know that it is a staple thing to say, my attending really like you to come and see this patient. And now that I'm an attending, I'm hearing other residents say that as well. And I know what that code means because I helped develop that code. What does that mean to you guys when you hear my attending would really appreciate if you would come and see this patient?
It means that they don't feel that the consult is indicated, but we're calling anyway.
What does that do as far as your consult? Because there are certain times where I think back as a resident and I go, oh yeah, I said that. And realistically, that actually probably is something that I would do now. And now I'm, first year out attending, and I'm probably a little overzealous. Like, well, just call. It would make me feel better. Humor me for this. And I hear the residents, So as a consultant, when you hear that, does it deter you at all? Does it put a bad face on it as you're coming in, or do you just go see the patient?
No, I think you go see the patient in those cases because the attending oftentimes is thinking in a way that the resident hasn't thought of. They've definitely had more experience, and it's reasonable enough that someone with more experience is concerned about this patient's care. And I have run it by my attending is what that says to me. That's a good thing, too.
Can you say that one more time about the attending having more experience than the resident?
The attendings have more experience than the resident. We trust that, too.
So there.
On the flip side of that, I don't think I see it much as much in the ED as I definitely see it on the floor. But a lot of times, the more senior individual involved doesn't realize essentially what is entailed when they say, "Oh, just give them a call." Like, "Oh, yeah," like they'll see something, and "Oh, yeah, just call ortho, see what they say," and then they're done. That was their 5-second input to that whole situation that now is created. That now someone more junior, with an intern on the floor, or someone now they're stuck calling. They call us. Then I'm like, well, what the hell are you calling me for anyway? And then I'm asking them more questions, and they're like, well, I knew wouldn't have called you, but my senior or attending or chief, whoever, said give you a call. And then I'm just sitting there getting more frustrated because I don't know why you're calling me. You don't know why you're calling me, but now you've called me, and now there is a consult, or is it a pseudo consult, or what is this? And what an attending or junior or senior, did in 5 seconds and forgot about now costs me an hour of OR time or anything of any time, because now instead of me trying to squeeze into the OR and learn down there, I'm going out trying to figure out what's going on with this, consult, seeing it, writing a consult note, staffing it, figuring out what to do with it. And so it really does extrapolate down the line.
The last question I have, why do my consultants always yell at me? Do you guys get classes on how to do that or something? Or because you're really good, too. Like, makes me cry a little bit inside. No, thank you guys so much. We always, I wanted to talk to the orthopedist because I think of the majority of our consultants, we have the best relationship with you guys. You guys are always reasonable. You come down, you help, you teach us a little bit. And especially, I've had several times where my resident says, I'd like to do this reduction. Great, let me show you how to do it. So we really appreciate working with you guys. Thank you very much for staying after your night shifts, too. So
thanks again to those guys. And sorry if the audio quality wasn't great. We were recording in that little radiology room downstairs, and it was tough to get a good sound. So you may or may not agree with what they had to say, but I think that those guys were pretty reasonable about the general suggestions. Whether or not your specific case with orthopedic surgery went well, I think they gave us a little bit of extra help. So I hope you consider some of the things that they said about how to make sure you frame a good consult. I totally agree with make sure that you have a question that you're asking your consultant, because it's going to make their job a whole lot easier. And that's going to make your job a whole lot easier, and that's hopefully going to result in better care for the patient. I'm not saying that there aren't times where you need to fight for your patient and stand up and be an advocate, but in general, we want to try to maintain as collegial a relationship with our consultants as possible.
In the Ferrari or Jaguar, switching four lanes, top down, screaming out, money ain't a thing.
Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holler back, money ain't a thing.
Jigga, I don't like it.
So it's been a while since we've had Kelly on, because with the advent of Epic, she's had to redo everything that she has done for years to try to keep our department running. But she was nice enough to sit down with us and give us a quick talk on splints, fracture and dislocation reductions, and general orthopedic billing. Those of you that don't think this is important, I guarantee you your boss, wherever you work, will disagree with you.
So, all right, Kelly.
All right. Let me back up first between the difference of when we actually would like to be able to bill for a splint, because I'll tell you, each and every time, remember, a splint is a component of fracture management. It's only a component. So when it comes down to choosing between a fracture code and a splint, I would much rather be able to bill for the fracture code.
Okay.
But there's times it's not appropriate. And what the coder is looking for is the definitive diagnosis. If you tell us in your note that I'm stabilizing this patient, I've been speaking to ortho over the phone, but I think there's a really good chance this patient's going to end up in the OR. So the orthopedic attending can't come down now, spoke to his resident, and they said, you know what, they're going to get him into clinic first thing in the morning. All you're doing is getting that patient from point A to B. You haven't managed the fracture. He may well tell you, and you agree, is that please put on a splint. If you yourself do it, this is what the feds require, because they know that most institutions have, what are they, UPCs or techs, or they have someone else who applies it. But if this is a fracture you're really concerned about, you don't want it to move and you don't want anybody else touching it, yes, you as the attending, if you put it on because of the medical necessity for it, you can bill for that.
So if I ask one of the paramedics, hey, go put on a sugar tongue splint on that patient, as opposed to if I myself go and do it, that's a huge difference as far as what we can take home. So do we need to include something after we've done the splint to say, I personally went back, reevaluated the splint, and it looked good?
That's right.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with the disposition. I'm confident the patient will be following up with ortho. Anything at all you add, we'll be billing for that splint.
Okay.
Now let's go back where we needed to be reduced first. A reduction or an alignment of a fracture, and you're in the room, or you pick the key and critical portion of that procedure, and you're in there. That is significant enough to bill for that actual fracture code.
Does it matter what we're reducing? A finger, an arm, a leg?
All those, absolutely. If you were there and you felt comfortable, let me tell you though, there's times I'll see an attending that for whatever reason, maybe you get a senior or a fifth year, is it a fifth year orthopedic resident?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll even put in their note, I was there to learn. I've had residents that actually started putting in some surgical procedure in the, because they're, you know, couldn't get into the OR right away, and they're literally putting in what nails, you tell me. But I'll see the attending say, I wasn't teaching him, I was here learning.
Mm-hmm.
In that scenario, of course not.
Okay.
But yes, otherwise we can bill for any splint, any fracture at all.
Okay. Any difference between a fracture and a dislocation as far as how you bill?
There are those, you know, with people having the...
where they do the total hip replacement?
That's correct. But they still sometimes pop out.
Mm-hmm.
They have reduced those RVUs because those patients, they come in, you know, they just twisted and it popped out again. You pop it in. By the way, it's great... Nice. That's a great chart.
And it's a lot of fun to do.
Okay.
So here's a case that I had about a week ago. This was a guy who came in. He chronically dislocates his shoulder. And there are websites devoted to how to reduce a shoulder. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've actually been able to do with one of my friends to talk him through it over the phone of step on your hand, slowly step up, and basically have the patient reduce their own shoulder. I've done that several times as a resident and when I was working briefly as a moonlighter, to have the patients, here, step on your hand, let me know when it goes back in. I go back in, we get repeat x-rays, and the shoulder's back in place. How do you decide whether or not to bill for that?
If you worded it that way, you're instructing the patient to do something, you're present for that.
Mm-hmm.
I bill for it.
Okay.
But we also see those cases where the patient came in, accidentally turned some way, twisted some way, and by the time the attending got in the room, they had quote-unquote self-reduced. Right. When you word it that way, of course we won't.
It's usually our x-ray techs that get it. Those nursemaid elbows that come in, we send them to x-ray, and hey, guess what? They're fine now.
Yeah. Those are not billed.
Awesome. Go for it.
The point I guess I would really like to make today is that it's really important to the residents to get the attendings present. Just make sure that you're telling the attending what you're doing and even give them an idea. And I'm going in the room, I'll need you there in about 10 or 15 minutes for a reduction. The attendings know what that means. Mm-hmm. And it's significant to both.
One other question, is there a difference in your mind or in the way that you code between an emergent fracture stabilization because you lost pulses, you lost sensation, or just a run-of-the-mill, we just needed to get it back into alignment in the emergency department?
No. Not in terms of billing. Does it affect the practice side and how we get billed or how we get paid? Never. Never. It's just not on the practice side.
So it sounds like this will go for pages upon pages of different codes and different ways of figuring it out. But for our purposes, make sure the attending is there.
make sure that we document whether or not we actually did the splint, and then make sure that we document the ins and outs of what happened during the reduction of either a fracture or a dislocation.
The coder will also look at the radiology report as well, but I think as we're approaching ICD-10, it really is important for the resident to be as definitive as they can. Give us the greatest specific diagnosis they can. By the way, there are 12 CPTs for a distal radial fracture. There's 12. So obviously the dollar amount is similar, but you want to get it.
Okay. Thank you for doing what you do so I don't have to.
You're welcome.
So let me try to summarize that into English and real life terms. So we need to try to be as specific as possible. Instead of saying broken arm, we can say left broken arm, or we can say left distal radius fracture, or we can say left Salter-Harris 2 distal radius fracture. These are things that help the coders. And trust me, in real life, you really want to do as much to help your coders so that they can help you. But we also need to make sure that we're being realistic, that we're not trying to put more diagnoses than are actually there, and that we say enough to complete the other aspects of our chart, that it's also a history of what happened to the patient, that it's a legal document, and that it's a communication between providers. So hopefully you guys get a little bit out of that, and you can talk to Kelly personally about all those pages and pages of ICD-9 codes. Well, that's it for this month. I hope you guys enjoyed that. We're going to bring Chris back again and do the other half of vasoactive drugs and pressors. We're also going to discuss, add a little bit about the real life for those of you seniors that are getting a job in a couple months, things like EMTALA. I'll tell you what, if there's one thing I wish I had learned more about, it would be EMTALA, because when you're on that phone, you don't want to make the wrong decision. But not to scare you, we hope you guys enjoy this podcast. Please send me more ideas. The ideas were really, really big at first, and now they're starting to taper off, both mine and yours. So please send me any ideas you have of how we can make the podcast better, different things you'd like to hear, and we'll try to put them on as soon as possible. Take care.